welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, December 5th. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. From the front page, month's virus death toll off to a bleak start. Iowa breaks COVID-19 fatality record for second straight day, by Lee Hermiston. In just the first 4 days of December, Iowa confirmed 200 COVID-19 deaths, nearly a third as many as recorded in the entire month of November, the worst monthly peak since the pandemic began. Friday morning, the state broke the record coronavirus death toll for the second day in a row, 84 new confirmed deaths on top of 70 a day earlier. Added to the 24 deaths recorded Tuesday and 22 added Wednesday, the state has confirmed 200 COVID-19 deaths in less than a week. Iowa confirmed 688 deaths in November, by far the deadliest month so far. Since the state reported its first COVID-19 death March 24th, 2,603 Iowans have died from it. With Worth County on Friday reporting its first death due to COVID-19, Decatur County stands alone in Iowa's 99 counties as not attributing a death to the pandemic. The most recently confirmed virus deaths, Blackhawk County reported 8, Polk County reported 6, Dubuque County added 5, and Woodbury County added 4. Cerro Gordo, Grundy, Jackson, Jefferson, Marshall, Pottawatomie, and Scott counties each reported 3 deaths. Butler, Des Moines, Floyd, Johnson, and Lee counties each reported 2. And Bremer, Carroll, Cass, Cedar, Chickasaw, Clay, Clayton, Clinton, Dallas, Dickinson, Green, Hamilton, Hardin, Iowa, Ida, Jones, Lynn, Louisa, Madison, Mills, Monona, Muscatine, Page, Poweshiek, Story, Tama, Union, Warren, Washington, and Worth counties each added 1. Among those deaths, nearly half, 39, were those 80 years old and above. 41 people ages 61 to 80 died, and the remaining 4 were people ages 18 to 60. Iowa added 2,905 new cases of the virus over a 24-hour period ending at 11 a.m. Friday, for a total so far of 239,699 cases. Linn County added 103 of those new cases for a total of 14,794 cases. Johnson County added 69 new cases, and its total stands at 9,883. Statewide, 4 new cases fell under the education occupation category, and 365 new cases were children under 17. 2 area long-term care facilities are no longer experiencing outbreaks: Terrace Glen Village in Linn County and Lantern Park Specialty Care in Johnson County, according to state data. Hospitalizations due to the virus decreased from 1,124 to 1,000 in the 24-hour period. The last time Iowa had fewer than 1,000 COVID-19 hospitalizations was November 8th. As of Friday morning, there were 209 virus patients in intensive care in Iowa hospitals and 128 on ventilators. From page 3, GOP criticizes, Dems defend, Hart's call for review of ballots. Miller Meeks, making an appeal to U.S. House is unfortunate, by Aaron Murphy and Rod Bossart. Whether Iowa's remarkably close second congressional district election should be ultimately resolved in an Iowa courtroom or the halls of Congress continued to be a point of political disagreement Friday. Republican Marionette Miller Meeks is the Congresswoman-elect after the state earlier this week officially certified the election results in which she edged Democrat Rita Hart by just 6 votes out of nearly 400,000 cast. Hart's campaign then submitted a petition under the Federal Contested Elections Act to the U.S. House asking for a full review of all ballots cast in the election. That includes what the Hart campaign says is thousands of ballots that were legally cast, but for myriad reasons not considered during the state recount. On Friday, Iowa Republicans criticized the Hart campaign for choosing to appeal the election results in the U.S. House, which is controlled by majority Democrats, instead of challenging the results in Iowa's courts. Quote, "I think it's unfortunate that we're taking the election out of Iowa, out of the voters of Iowa's hands, and putting it into the partisan political process," unquote, Miller Meeks said Friday during this weekend's recording of Iowa Press for Iowa PBS. "I think it's unfortunate, but that is a process that is open to her to proceed." The district covers 24 southeast Iowa counties and includes Iowa City, Davenport, and Ottumwa. The winner will succeed U.S. Representative Dave Loebsack, a Democrat who has served 7 terms. The Hart campaign has said the U.S. House appeal is the preferred route because Iowa state law does not allow sufficient time to review the number of ballots the Hart campaign believes should be reviewed. The Hart campaign said 2 curbside votes were not counted due to errors by poll workers. At least 30 ballots from military members were not counted due to a scanning error, and thousands of ballots and thousands of ballots were not examined consistently across the district's counties during the recount. Quote, "There are thousands of undervotes and overvotes, as well as 35 overseas and military ballots from Scott County left to be examined and counted," Hart campaign communications director Riley Kilberg said in an email. "This shouldn't be about one political party or another. It's about protecting every Iowan's right to have their voice heard," unquote. State House Republican leaders Jack Whitaker, the Iowa Senate Majority Leader, and Pat Grassley, the Iowa House Speaker, issued a joint statement through the Republican Party of Iowa, to which they urged legislative Democrats to, quote, "take a stand against overturning the will of Iowa's second district voters." Quote, "On election night, Rita Hart lost. After mistakes were corrected, Rita Hart lost. After requesting a recount in all 24 counties, Rita Hart lost," unquote, Grassley said. The Republicans said Hart is asking Democratic U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to, quote, "negate the will of Iowa's voters through a sham process. This is shameful and erodes trust in the integrity of our elections," unquote. Earlier this week, Iowa's Republican U.S. Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst criticized the Hart campaign for the U.S. House appeal. Mark Smith, chairman of the Iowa Democratic Party, said the U.S. House is the only body that is constitutionally allowed to conduct a full recount of all legally cast ballots in the 2nd District, and they should do that so Iowans have full confidence in the results of this election. Quote, "Rita is right to move forward with the election process in a way that protects the voting rights of every Iowan," unquote. Hinson says Biden's call for masks coincides with governor's advice, by James Q. Lynch. President-elect Joe Biden's call for 100 days of mask wearing coincides with Governor Kim Reynolds' message to Iowans to do their part to slow the spread of COVID-19, Congresswoman-elect Ashley Hinson said Friday. Quote, "I think our governor has already made it very clear that we want people to wear masks if they can't properly social distance," unquote, the Marion Republican said, without fully embracing Biden's suggestion Americans have a, quote, patriotic duty to wear masks. Most Iowans must wear a mask or other face covering while they are indoors in public and near other people for at least 15 minutes under a November public health order issued by Reynolds. Her order also placed a limit of 15 people on all indoor gatherings, including wedding and funeral receptions, family gatherings, conventions, and festivals. It limited outdoor gatherings to 30 people. Biden, who will take office in January, said earlier this week he will ask Americans to commit to 100 days of wearing masks. President Donald Trump's skepticism of mask wearing has made many people reticent to embrace a practice that public health experts say is one of the easiest ways to manage the pandemic, which has killed more than 275,000 Americans. Biden has frequently emphasized mask wearing and during the campaign floated the idea of instituting a nationwide mask mandate, which he later acknowledged would be beyond the ability of the president to enforce. Hinson, who spoke to reporters while waiting to board a plane from Washington to Cedar Rapids, agreed that you can't socially distance. You probably should be wearing a mask in public right now, unquote. However, Hinson, who isolated earlier this month after testing positive for COVID-19, added, quote, I wore a mask and I still got it, unquote. She urged people to continue to socially distance and for people who are sick or have an underlying health condition to stay home. Search committee aims to have new University of Iowa president hired by April 30th by Vanessa Miller. The committee searching for the next president of the University of Iowa said Friday it hopes to have the post filled by April 30th. That timeline, revealed during the search committee's first meeting, has the 21-member group choosing semifinalists by March 22nd, interviewing them and identifying finalists by April 6th or 7th, and bringing finalists for campus visits by April 19th and 23rd. The campus would gather feedback about the candidates through April 29th, with the Board of Regents interviewing finalists and choosing the 22nd University of Iowa president by April 30th. UI President Bruce Harreld announced his retirement in October, saying he wanted to allow more time to find his replacement during pandemic conditions. Harreld, who started in 2015 and last year signed a contract to stay until 2023 or forfeit $2.33 million in deferred compensation, told Regents he was giving early notice to allow better succession planning and after asking experts how long a typical search takes these days. Some members of the UI search committee on Friday raised questions about wrapping up the search in under 4 months after the job is advertised starting January 14th. Specifically, members expressed unease about virtual listening sessions with campus community groups this winter, seeking input on what they'd like in a next leader. Those sessions are slated from Monday through December 20th, a period that encompasses finals week from December 14th to 18th. Quote, a lot of faculty will be burdened with coursework, students should be studying, and the timing of the sessions relative to workload. My concern is that will have a negative impact on attendance, unquote, said UI Dentistry Professor Teresa Marshall, Vice President of the Faculty Senate and a search committee member. Sandra Dack Hirsch, search committee co-chair and interim executive associate dean of the University of Iowa College of Nursing, acknowledged that was considered in crafting the quote, aggressive timeline, unquote. But delaying the sessions puts them closer to the holiday season when community members either aren't on campus or aren't engaging in UI business. Graduate College Dean John Keller, search committee co-chair, said delaying the listening sessions could push out the process a month or so. Quote, It would really compress the time frame even further if we were trying to have a slate of candidates for the board to consider by the end of the spring semester, unquote, Keller said, noting search leaders aim to counter finals week conflicts by having more sessions virtually. When asked whether that April 30th deadline is very firm, Keller said, "This is our goal." "It is aggressive," he said, noting the committee's partner, AGB Search, has affirmed, quote, "This is possible, but I think we all are in agreement. We are not going to try to unnecessarily delay the process or unnecessarily speed it up," unquote. Some concern arose about the confidentiality agreement committee members were asked to sign. UI Faculty Senate President and committee member Joseph Yockey, for example, raised concerns about a clause prohibiting discussion about closed session deliberations with other committee members outside the closed session. Quote, "That would suggest that, for example, I couldn't seek clarity from John and Sandy if I was confused about something that came up in the closed session," unquote, Yockey said. "That seems to me far broader than is necessary to protect the confidentiality of candidates," unquote. The group collectively decided not to sign the confidentiality agreement until they have more time to discuss amendments and issue a revised version. Cedar Rapids Nix's in-person Christmas tree lighting ceremony by Marissa Payne. Tonight's ceremony can be seen on Facebook. There won't be much rocking around the Christmas tree downtown this year. Because of the pandemic, the city of Cedar Rapids will not host its usual in-person tree lighting ceremony, complete with carolers, activities, and food trucks that typically draws a crowd of 200 to 300 people. Residents will still may visit the tree and snap holiday photos in Green Square, but the city will post signage to encourage visitors to practice social distancing. Residents also may celebrate the virtual lighting of the Christmas tree at 5:30 p.m. today via the city's Facebook page, with a video featuring a message from Mayor Brad Hart, a story read by Mrs. Claus, and a countdown including Santa and city employees. Quote, "We debated because of the derecho, because of COVID. Is this something we should be doing?" City Parks Recreation Director Scott Hawk said. "I think the final thought was a little bit of normalcy in life right now. Maybe people would really appreciate that. So that was kind of the reason that we thought we'd do it again this year too," unquote. The Thompson family of Cedar Rapids will help light the Colorado spruce that they donated. The city, in announcing the virtual tree lighting ceremony in its newsletter, said now more than ever, after the August 10th derecho, the city is sensitive to the loss of any tree. The trees used for the lighting are private trees that the owners need to have removed, typically because they have overgrown their space. Quote, "This was one that was needing to come down, so we want to repurpose those and get a little extra life out of it," unquote, Hawk said. Several other trees that were on the city's list of potential holiday trees sustained damage in the derecho, Hawk said. With Cedar Rapids estimating its loss, it lost at least 65% of its tree canopy. It's too soon to say how the sensitivity surrounding lost trees will affect holiday tree selection in the future, Hawk said. Quote, "It's a long-standing tradition, so we want to make sure and kind of vet the ideas a little bit and see what other suggestions people have and look at what other cities are doing and look for what the best option is for us in Cedar Rapids," he said. $9 million coming to forestall evictions, help Iowa homeless, by John Stepp. Almost $9 million in funding from the Federal CARES Act will be available for low-income Iowans at imminent risk of eviction, Iowans who already are evicted, and to homeless shelter operations, Governor Kim Reynolds announced Friday. Along with being at imminent risk of an eviction, a resident also must earn 50% or less of the area median income to be eligible. Anyone already homeless is eligible. Quote, the funds announced today will assist those at risk of eviction while also providing support to homeless shelters, supporting Iowa's homeless population at this critical time, unquote, Reynolds said in a news release. I appreciate the continued collaboration with our federal partners in support of this state's pandemic response. Unquote. The pandemic moratorium on evictions expires December 31st. The funding is through the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development's Emergency Solutions Grant Program. Funding will go directly to the recipient's landlord or service provider, according to a news release. Several corridor nonprofits received assistance in the most recent round of emergency solutions grant allocations. In Linn County, four agencies, the Area Substance Abuse Council, Catherine McCauley Center, Hawkeye Area Community Action Program, and Waypoint Willis Dady Emergency Center received grants ranging from $35,500 to $1.2 million. The city of Cedar Rapids also received $150,000. In Johnson County, Shelter House received $802,880, and the Domestic Violence Intervention Program received $419,864. Sassy, stubborn, and spirited. 8-year-old Cedar Rapids girl battling a rare cancer by Trish Mahaffey. When 8-year-old Gracie Springer cruises down the sidewalk in her electric vehicle, a Mercedes-Benz with the radio cranked, she looks like any other kid her age. The second grader, bundled up in a jacket of her favorite color, purple, with matching pom-pom stocking beanie, is a little wobbly at the wheel, but not bad for a first-time driver. She goes as fast as possible, 3.6 miles per hour, attempting a sharp turn at the top of a hill. She gets stuck, but doesn't even think about asking Mom for help. Her mother, Kelsey Springer, 27, of Cedar Rapids, described her as sassy, stubborn, and spirited. But as quickly as she said it, she added, that's what she fears most will change about Gracie after Monday. I'm going to miss that, Springer said Thursday as she stood outside her house watching Gracie tear up the hill. We've let her play as much as possible because everything will change. Gracie starts chemotherapy Monday. She was diagnosed last month with Ewing's sarcoma, a rare cancer that most typically is found in children and young adults. She has a large tumor attached to her mastoid bone, just behind the ear, and it grew into her brain. Springer said her daughter started having headaches off and on, along with stomach aches, in October, but they started occurring more frequently and grew more severe. She and her partner, Marty Tope, 31, Gracie's father, weren't sure what was going on, but never even thought about cancer. Gracie then had a severe headache and couldn't stop vomiting November 14th. Springer took her to Mercy Medical Center, and a CT scan showed a mass on her brain. She quickly was transferred to the University of Iowa Stead Family Children's Hospital, where she had an MRI that identified the mass and showed brain swelling. On November 16th, Gracie had a craniotomy to relieve pressure on the brain, and surgeons were able to remove most of the tumor. The doctor said, though, there still could be some cancer cells. Springer said this surgery was traumatic for Gracie because of her age and because she had to shave her head. Gracie had long brown hair with beautiful body, her mother added. Springer cut Gracie's locks and Tope shaved her head. She had a panic attack, so Marty shaved his head to support her, Springer said. Tope, a Linn County Sheriff's deputy, then tested positive for COVID-19 and couldn't be with her at the hospital. Not being able to go to the hospital was difficult for Tope. I was texting and calling and then worried when I couldn't reach Kelsey, Tope said. Kelsey was sleeping at the hospital with Gracie. My body would just wake me up after the surgery. I couldn't sleep. It was hard. The parents learned Gracie had Ewing sarcoma before Thanksgiving on November 20th. The doctor told them only about 1% of all childhood cancers are Ewing tumors, and only 1% of those attached to the head or neck area. According to the American Cancer Society, about 200 children and teens are diagnosed with Ewing's tumors each year in the United States. I can't even describe how we felt, Springer said. It's been hard. Gracie will have to have an estimated 28 to 30 weeks of chemo, and radiation therapy will be added at some point. Tope said they waited a few days to tell Gracie. She doesn't understand everything, he said. Springer said Gracie knows she has cancer but feels good now. She doesn't know the side effects of chemo and how sick she will become. She knows it's a long road ahead and has anxiety about what will happen next. Gracie has been watching a Netflix series about cancer, and she has been asking questions about death, which Springer said has been disturbing for her. I couldn't have imagined her being this healthy after the last month's surgery, Tope said as he watched Gracie this week drive down the sidewalk. She's always like this. She loves music and to dance. She loves to watch those baking shows and make things out of Play-Doh, play doctor and ride her bike. She just learned last summer. Springer said Gracie wanted an electric car for a long time and specifically asked for a two-seater so she could take her 15-month-old brother, Jackson, for a ride. It's her favorite thing to do now. Springer's former boss, Randy Evans, gave Gracie the car about a week ago. He found out about the cancer and wanted to give her something she always wanted. Earlier this week, Springer said the family was waiting on bone marrow test results to determine if the cancer had spread. On Thursday, she told Tope the test came back negative. Both felt relieved. They said the only way they were getting through this was with help from family, friends, and co-workers. The sheriff's special response team, which Tope is on, surprised Gracie on Monday with a lights and sirens parade of 10 or more squad vehicles. Leading the way was the Bearcat, an armored tactical response vehicle used in active shooter situations. Team members also wanted to show her their shaved heads. Sergeant John Hoskins, assigned to the 19-member team and Tope's immediate supervisor, said he wanted to do something just for Gracie to show she is part of the department's family. So I thought, why don't we shave our heads? Hoskins said. We can show her it's a good luck. We can all pull it off. I think she liked it. When Trim's barber in Marion heard about what deputies wanted to do, the owners shaved their heads for free, Hoskins said. Hoskins, who also grew up with Tope, said Tracy's reaction to the parade was just like Christmas. Her face lit up, he said. Springer said Gracie initially was stunned when she came out and saw the guys. She was a little shy and nervous because they were a bunch of boys, but she got excited when they let her get in the Bearcat with her dad and stand up through the roof's opening, Springer said. Gracie's principal and teachers at Nixon Elementary School and her classmates also have been supportive. Springer said it's been an isolating time for Gracie, first with the coronavirus, and now because she has to limit her contact with her teachers and friends. Her class sent her get well cards, which meant so much, Springer said. Tope's sister also set up a GoFundMe page to help the family and update everyone on Gracie's progress. Springer knows this will be a lifelong battle for Gracie, but she has faith the little girl will beat it. Tope said he is taking one day at a time. I'm not looking ahead, he said. I just want to make the most of each day. Gracie already set 5 goals for after chemo and radiation. Go to a Kansas City Chiefs game and Disney World, get her ears pierced, take gymnastics, and see her parents marry. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, December 5th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. From Amana, Alberta Voles, 98, died Thursday, December 3rd. Brosh Funeral Service, Norway. Cedar Rapids, Jackie W. Harris, Jr., died Friday, November 20th. Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services, Cedar Rapids. Decorah, Peggy Crummy, 72, died Wednesday, December 2nd. Schluter Balick Funeral Home, Decorah. Iowa City, Georgia J. Casper, 71, died Thursday, December 3rd. Lansing Funeral and Cremation Services, Iowa City. Lansing, Lloyd W. Rolfs, 84, of Lansing, formerly of Castalia, died Thursday, December 3rd. Martin Grau Funeral Home, Waukon. Sigourney, Jean Cavan, 88, died Friday, December 4th. Holm Funeral Home, Sigourney. Vinton, Barbara E. Phelps, 75, died Friday, December 4th. Phillips Funeral Home, Vinton. Walker, Eileen A. Knight, 93, died Friday, November 4th. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Center Point. Waukon, Thomas Tom J. Collins, 67, died Friday, December 4th. Martin Grau Funeral Home, Waukon. Robert E. Bob Blakesley, Cedar Rapids. Robert E. Bob Blakesley, 67, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, passed away on Sunday, October 25th at Ohlsdorf Hospice House in Hiawatha, Iowa. Bob has been cremated and no service is planned. White Funeral Home, Independence, was entrusted with interment of his ashes at Mount Hope Cemetery. Some will be scattered on his beloved Wapsipinicon River by hometown friends. Online condolences may be left at www.whitemthope.com. Rachel L. Barnes, Keystone. Rachel L. Barnes, 38, of Keystone, died Wednesday, December 2nd at St. Luke's Hospital. A celebration of life service will be held at a later date. Beverly Colin Baggy Mason, Iowa City. Beverly Colleen Baggy Mason, 90, of Iowa City, died in the early morning of Sunday, November 29th, in her sleep at Pleasant View Home in Kelowna. Private family services will be held with burial to take place at Memorial Gardens Cemetery in Iowa City. Larry L. Mostert, Clarence. Larry L. Mostert, 82, passed away Thursday, December 3rd at Unity Point Health, St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids, following surgery and complications of diabetes. There will be a visitation from 9:30 to 11 a.m. Tuesday, December 8th at St. John's United Church of Christ in Clarence, with a private family service to follow. The Reverend Sue Schneider Adams will be officiating. Burial will be at St. John Cemetery with military rites. Chapman Funeral Home has Larry and his family in their care. Memorials, memories, and condolences may be left at www.chapmanfh.com. Beverly J. Bev Canuck, Des Moines. Beverly J. Bev Canuck of Des Moines died on Wednesday, December 2nd at Scottish Rite Park, Des Moines. She passed peacefully in her sleep 5 days following her 93rd birthday. A graveside committal and funeral service will be held with immediate family at 1:30 p.m. Saturday, December 5th at the Oakland Cemetery, Iowa City, Iowa. The Reverend Joseph Sia will be officiating. Additional family and friends are welcome to attend via live stream. A live stream of the funeral service may be accessed on the funeral home website tribute page for Bev under photos and videos or media. A celebration of life will be held post-COVID-19. Arrangements by Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Marion. Mary Ann Dunkel, 78, of Anamosa, died Thursday, December 3rd at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Private services will be held for the family on Tuesday, December 8th at Getch Funeral Home, Anamosa. The Reverend Nick March will officiate. By visiting www.getchonline.com, you may share your thoughts, memories, and condolences with the family. Thomas J. Anderson, Fort Collins, Colorado. Thomas J. Anderson, 83, of Fort Collins, Colorado, formerly of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, passed away on December 3rd at home with his family by his side after a prolonged battle with cancer. Tom will be laid to rest at the City of Loveland Burial Park. Memorials may be made to Redeemer Lutheran Church at Fort Collins, Colorado. Clayton John Klein, Tiffin. Clayton John Klein, 90, of Tiffin, died at his home with his family near on Wednesday, December 2nd, 2020. Graveside services with military honors will be held at 11:30 a.m. on Monday, December 7th at Oak Hill Cemetery, west of Tiffin. To share a thought, memory, or condolence with his family, please visit the funeral home website at www.gayandsia.com. Daniel D. Dan Lilly, Iowa City. Daniel D. Dan Lilly, 70, of Iowa City, passed away Friday, November 20th, at Mercy Hospital in Iowa City following an extended illness. Dan chose to be cremated. No services are planned at this time. Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City is handling arrangements. Harold James Jim LaRue, Oxford. Harold James Jim LaRue, 94, of rural Oxford, died Wednesday, December 2nd, at Crestview Care Center in West Branch. Private family services will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, December 5th, at Gay and Sia Funeral and Cremation Services. The services will be live streamed for friends and extended family. Please share your support and memories with Jim's family and find a link to the live stream details on his live stream link at www.gayandsia.com under obituaries. This can be viewed anytime during and after the services. Burial with military honors will be held at Memory Garden Cemetery. A service celebrating Jim's life will be held at a later date to be announced. Richard Dick Saravi, Solon. Richard Dick Saravi, 86, died peacefully in his home, surrounded by his loving family, on December 2nd. A private visitation and funeral service will be held at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Interment with military honors will follow at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. A live stream of the service can be viewed at client.tributecast.com/TCID/318-404-60. As mandated by proclamation, social distancing must be practiced, which requires a limited number of people to be allowed into the visitation at one time. The use of face masks or shields is required. John A. Bell, Marion. John A. Bell, 90, passed away peacefully December 3rd at the Monticello Nursing and Rehabilitation Center. Family would like to thank the staff at MNRC for the care and kindness shown John the past 2 years, but especially the loving care during this horrible COVID-19 pandemic. Barbara Welch Brader. Barbara Welch Brader, Iowa City, died unexpectedly on November 30th at home. Barbara is survived by members of her family and countless friends. A memorial service is planned for later in 2021. Online condolences may be made at lansingfuneral.com. Cheryl J. Shoon, Haven, Kansas. Cheryl J. Shoon, 83, passed away December 3rd at Reflections Nursing Home, Hutchinson, Kansas. Friends may pay their respects to Cheryl from 2 to 4 p.m. Sunday, December 6th at the Ott Funeral Home, Haven. The family will not be present. Funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Monday, December 7th at Our Redeemer Lutheran Church, Hutchinson. Burial will follow at Laurel Cemetery, Haven. Please observe social distancing. Masks are required. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be given to Our Redeemer Lutheran Church or the American Parkinson Disease Association. Betty Jane Peck Peterson, Wyoming. Betty Jane Peck Peterson, 94, of Wyoming, passed away on Thursday, December 3rd at the Clarence Nursing Home. Her funeral service will be held at 1:30 p.m. Monday, December 7th. Excuse me, at Zion American Lutheran Church. A visitation will be held prior to the service from noon to 1 p.m. at Zion American Lutheran Church. Burial will be at Wyoming Cemetery. Masks are required for those attending and social distancing guidelines will be followed. Dawson Funeral Home Services of Wyoming is assisting the family. Now we're turning to the sports page. Northern Iowa Men's Basketball, Minds Wandering But Panthers Win, by Cole Blair. Dateline Cedar Falls. Balls were bouncing, sneakers were squeaking, and referees were blowing their whistles again at McLeod Center last night. But despite Northern Iowa's comfortable 98-53 win over St. Ambrose, minds were largely elsewhere. UNI's junior guard, A.J. Green, missed the game with a hip injury. The team announced earlier in the day he's continuing to get evaluated. Head coach Ben Jacobson said on his weekly radio show Thursday that Green will be out indefinitely while he decides whether to rest, rehab, and play through the injury, have season-ending surgery, or perhaps discover a third option. Jacobson revealed that Green has dealt with general tightness before in his hips, but didn't experience pain until their game against St. Mary's last Thursday at the Crossover Classic in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Jacobson added reorganizing the offense without Green will be important going forward. However, their emphasis as a staff was communicating with the team as Green evaluates his injury and sophomore guard Antoine Kimmons takes a leave of absence for family reasons related to the pandemic. Quote, anything to do with our players, our staff, our program, Jacobson said. Anything to do with those things are just going to take precedent over what's going on with a single game or adjustments to the offense or defense, unquote. Without Green, the Panthers easily outclassed the NAIABs, shooting 52% from the field and making 10 three-pointers. Senior guard Trey Burhau returned to the starting lineup after missing all three games last week because of COVID and led all scorers with 19 points. After the win, Burhau revealed that he was cleared by the doctor last Wednesday and drove 2 hours toward Sioux Falls to join his teammates before getting a call from Jacobson telling him the tournament would not allow him to play. Quote, it felt like yesterday we were just playing here with all the fans, so just during the warm-ups it was weird. But it feels like home, unquote, Burhau said. It kind of just explains this year. Got to just go with the flow and take the hits. The freshmen are stepping up. Sophomores are stepping up. It's going to be an interesting year. Joining Burhau in double figures last night was Noah Carter, 17 points, Bowen Bourne, 16, James Betts, 14, and Nate Heiss, 11. UNI travels to Virginia on Wednesday for a 5 p.m. tip against 2-0 Richmond on ESPN+. In boys basketball, Spartans hold off Clippers by Mike Condon, Dateline, Solon. Jared Galpin said his Solon boys basketball team didn't finish in its season opener. The Spartans led their opener with DeWitt Central earlier this week, slip away late, losing 61-56. They didn't make the same mistake twice. Solon led the entire first half, then saw visiting Clear Creek Amana take a 30-28 lead, scoring the first 4 points of the second half. However, the Spartans responded with a 12-0 run of their own to regain control and went on to post a 66-56 WAMAC Conference win last night. Quote, "We didn't finish on Monday," Galpin said of the loss to DeWitt Central. "It was a similar situation to what we ended up having tonight. We really emphasized that all week in practice, getting out to a fast start in the third quarter and then finishing the game strong," unquote. The third quarter run featured a pair of three-point baskets from Ben Cusick and David Bluter to put the Spartans back up 40-30. The visitors did make a couple of runs, cutting the deficit to 4 after three quarters. In the fourth, the Spartans were able to come up with big shots when they needed them most to keep the Clippers at bay. "We're better when we play inside out," Galpin said. Dave Bluter hit some big shots. Ben Cusick hit a big one, and Bo Jensen also hit a big one. "Those were all really big shots to stifle their momentum and get our momentum back," unquote. Carson Shive led Solon 1-1 with 18 points. Bluter finished with 15. Quote, "I thought we grew up a lot tonight," said Galpin, who got his first win as the Spartans head coach. "We played with confidence, were strong with the ball, and maintained control of the game," unquote. Friday's game was the opener for the Clippers, a state tournament team last season. Ryan Navarra led the way with 16 points, while Christian Withrow added 13. Solon's next scheduled game is at home, Tuesday night against Williamsburg. Clear Creek Amana remains on the road Tuesday, playing at Maquoketa. In girls basketball, "Catching On and Up" by Jeff Linder, Dateline Tiffin. Due to online learning, Clear Creek Amana didn't have its first practice until the middle of last week. The Clippers obviously have caught on and caught up quickly. Kalia Club posted 14 points, 16 rebounds, and 5 assists, and Class 4A 14th-ranked CCA capitalized on a substantial size advantage to defeat 3A number 14 Solon 63-44 in a WAMAC Conference cross-division girls basketball game last night at Clear Creek Amana High School. Quote, "My coaches give me a rebound goal every game, and I really want to get that," Club said. "Today, that goal was 18, unquote. Club is one of three returning starters from last year's state tournament team, the first in school history. The Clippers figured to be at a disadvantage Friday because they hadn't played a game yet, had to cram 10 practices into 9 days. They looked well-schooled and well-prepared. They knew where their advantage was, in the paint. Quote, "We took advantage of our size and our length," CCA coach P.J. Sweeney said. "Solon has a lot of 5'6 and 5'8 kids, so we wanted to pound it inside." They did, on the way to a 15-2 lead after a quarter. After the Spartans brought more defenders into the lane, that opened up the arc, and the Clippers hit 4 of 6 shots from three-point range in the second quarter. CCA led 38-15 at intermission. Quote, "We're a different team from last year, but we didn't see that as a bad thing," said Club, a junior who recently committed to play volleyball at Illinois State. "We push the inside pass whenever we can, and we can read each other well," unquote. 8 CCA players scored 4 points or more, Whitney Traitow, 11 points, and Olivia Miller, 10, joined club in double figures. Callie Levin, a freshman who already has picked up multiple Division I offers, scored 20 of her 24 points in the second half to lead Solon. The Spartans got as close as 16 points on three occasions in the fourth quarter. Next, we turn to Mike Klaas's column, Iowa State and Iowa, Eye Satisfaction Today. Hawkeye fans, with whom I've spent many a dangerous hour in some of the darker corners of eastern Iowa, have restored my faith in them as something other than rogues and rascals. This week, via Twitter, I asked them which of the following football teams they'd rather have Iowa face in week 9 of this college football season. Indiana, Maryland, Ohio State, Rutgers. They overwhelmingly chose Ohio State. That opportunity probably wouldn't present itself, but that's irrelevant. They made the right call. You live for the challenge, to do something difficult knowing it comes with a risk of failure and perhaps even embarrassment. If you wanted an easier go of it, you'd move to the NFC East and beat up on the 4 sad sacks there. The quest is for championships, yes, but there's a second goal that's just as important. That's satisfaction. You can't attain it without beating someone believed to be above your weight class. How many teams from the 5 major football conferences will exit this season with true satisfaction? Very few, I'd say. If you're Alabama or Clemson or Ohio State and don't win the national title, you don't. If you're one of the highly ranked SEC teams that don't reach that league's title game, there's a hollow spot in those souls. Wisconsin's start and stop season can't be fun. If Oklahoma wins the Big 12 without a college football playoff berth, it's half a loaf. What if Notre Dame goes unbeaten until its ACC title game rematch with Clemson and then gets smashed? Then there are the programs expected to be superpowers, your Texas, your Michigan, your Penn State, your Florida State, your LSU. Oh, the emptiness in those places these days. In our state, both teams have found different degrees of fulfillment, and both have the chances to add to them and have the opportunity to escape 2020 with something resembling joy. Iowa State, of course, has done so by going where no Cyclone team has ever gone before. That's to the top of the Big 12 standings. A victory over West Virginia today gives ISU the outright regular season conference title in the same week they zoom to 9th in the CFP rankings. That in itself is enough to call it a great year. You can lose to Oklahoma in the Big 12 championship. You can lose a bowl game to somebody of merit, but you've got that 8-1 record in the conference, that first place finish you got by facing every team in the league. It's the only Power 5 league in which everyone faces everyone else, so ending on top of the standings means more. And of course, Iowa State would give itself another chance to add to its resume if it faced Oklahoma again. Yes, the Sooners are better than when they lost in Ames several weeks ago, and so are the Cyclones. But with a win over West Virginia, this season is an unqualified success for Iowa State, no matter how the rest of the story is written. Iowa can turn an 0-2 start into an 8-2 finish. It's halfway there. Winning at Illinois today is expected, but I'd wager a lot of magic beans it won't be nearly as easy as the Hawkeyes' last few trips there. Then you have Wisconsin at home. Winning that would give enormous pleasure to a team and fan base that has endured 4 straight losses to the Badgers. It would easily be the most enjoyable result of the season. Next, you have the December 19th opponent. Let's say it's Indiana. Good team, ranked team. It would be a meaningful win. Then there's some cockamamie bowl game against heaven knows who. Win that, you close with 8 straight W's and feel pretty good about yourself all through the off season. So, while so many programs are about to enter winters of discontent, Minnesota, Nebraska, Michigan, and Penn State leap to mind, Iowa State and Iowa can have off-season bliss if they continue on the paths they've been traveling lately. Of course, if the Bulls and ESPN conspire to do the right thing and have the Cyclones and Hawkeyes meet in the postseason, one of the two will bow out with the Blues. Perhaps they should worry about disposing of West Virginia and Illinois first. For the vital stats today, Iowa at Illinois. Records. Number 19, Iowa is 4-2, 4-2 in the Big Ten. Illinois is 2-3 and 2-3. The time on TV is 2:30 p.m. at FS1. Radio, WMT 600, KXIC 800. Did you know? The Hawkeyes are 12-7-1 in December games and 2-0 in the regular season games in the month. West Virginia at Iowa State University. Records. West Virginia is 5-3, 4-3 in the Big 12, number 9. Iowa State is 7-2 overall and 7-1. Time on TV, 2:30 p.m. on ESPN. Radio, KGYM 1600. Did you know? ISU is 23-12 in the conference play the last four seasons, the second most wins in the league during that span. TV's best bets, Texas A&M at Auburn at 11 a.m. ESPN. Indiana at Wisconsin, 2:30 p.m. KCRG. And BYU at Coastal Carolina, 4:30 p.m. ESPNU. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, December 5th. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.